This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I will read Bodhisattva's vow and offer a few comments on it in light of the Paris attacks. When I, a student of the way, look at the real form of the universe, all is the never-failing manifestation of the mysterious truth of the awakened life. In any event, in any moment, and in any place, none can be other than the marvelous revelation of its glorious light. This realization made our ancestors and teachers extend tender care with respectful hearts, even to such beings as birds and beasts. This realization teaches us that our daily food, drink, clothes, and protections of life are the warm flesh and blood, the merciful incarnation of the Awakened One. Who can be ungrateful or not respectful? Even to senseless things, not to speak of human beings. Even though they may be fools, be warm and compassionate towards them. If by any chance they should turn against us, become a sworn enemy and abuse and persecute us, we should sincerely bow down with humble language in the reverent understanding that they are the merciful messengers of the Awakened One who use devices to emancipate us from blind tendencies produced and accumulated upon ourselves by our own egoistic delusion and attachment through countless cycles of space and time. Then on each moment's flash of our thought, there will grow a lotus flower, and on each lotus flower will be revealed perfection, unceasingly manifest as our life, just as it is, right here and right now. May we extend this mind to all beings so that we and the world together may attain maturity and the wisdom of the awakened life. This verse offers us a very steep challenge in the light of recent events and offers a perspective on the suffering and tragedy of the world that we, in reciting it, endeavor to attain, even though in many ways it seems very far away and difficult to embody. It begins by speaking of the real form of the universe from the perspective of a student of the way. And all is the never-failing manifestation of the truth of the awakened life. what is the real form of the universe? How do we see it differently from an awakened perspective? I think fundamentally Buddhism teaches us that all things in this life share two characteristics: interdependence and impermanence. And when we look for the real form of the universe, fundamentally we are seeing it as interconnected, ever-changing, ungraspable, which is another way of saying empty in each of its particulars. Language like the marvelous revelation of its glorious light, I think, can give us an image as if we see through the appearances of the world to its real form, which is in some sense behind the appearances of the world, which is more real than the appearances of the world. As if that there is a light shining through the curtain of appearances. Yet I think that kind of imagery or that kind of wishful fantasy goes against the basic teaching of Buddha, that things have no permanent essential nature. There is nothing behind the scenes. To see things in an awakened perspective is to see the nature of the scene clearly in its empty, interconnected, ever-changing nature. And yet, that realization, to see things as they are, it's not to see them, like I say, it's not to see something spiritual or permanent or ideal behind the scenes that we see through too. To see true nature is to simply see the characteristics of everything in front of us. And yet what this verse describes is the fact that seeing that is not a objective, neutral, emotionally detached or cold perspective, but that there is some way in which to see things clearly involves a certain kind of warm and affective response to them. No particular reason that this would necessarily follow, but it does. And one way to understand that might be to say that most of the time we are in a state of anxious or fearful denial or apprehension about reality. We see things, they are interconnected and impermanent, and it scares the hell out of us. Because we get the idea that it might apply to us too. And so everyone responds to this state of affairs by trying to create in their imagination its opposite. Something permanent, unchanging, reliable. Sometimes they do that at the level of the material world or their sense of their own permanent self-identity. sometimes they'll create a picture of a permanent ideal God or other world. Something is going to be unchanging and permanent. That we'll be able to rely on. But it's all driven by our basic anxiety at seeing the emptiness of things. Yet there's something about the awakened way that doesn't just look in a kind of cold, unflinching way at the nature of the world, but looks with respectful hearts extending tender care. And it means being able to see the impermanence of the world with tenderness. One way I think of this myself is that we can have the kind of experience we have when we see a newborn baby, which embodies all the vulnerability of fragility of the world, all the dependency and fragility that we're quite afraid of in ourselves, applying to our own lives. But in the baby, somehow we see the dependency and vulnerability are inevitably its natural condition. It's part of being a baby. You can't be a baby without vulnerability and dependency, right? And in that baby, we're able to love and accept the very things that normally scare us. We see the naturalness and appropriateness of it in the baby. And we naturally have a kind of warm and delighted response. This seems to simply spring forth from us as one creature to another. And I would suggest to you that seeing the real form of the universe, something about the nature of the experience of enlightenment, is to extend that affective state that we might feel to a baby, to one another and to all things, where we see, accept, and even delight in the fact of our mutual dependence and vulnerability, that this is not a terrible flaw in our nature, but is precisely what it is to be human. See, I think that so often we get a mistaken picture of the nature of enlightenment, where people act as if now they see things as they really are. Finally, we pull aside the veil of appearances and we see the thing in itself, right? But really what counts in any kind of experience like that is whether it's accompanied by a sense of warmth, acceptance, delight, compassion. Right? It's not a matter of, well, now I see what it's all about. It's really, what kind of emotional response does it call forth? And that's what I think this verse really inspires. To see things clearly is to extend tender care and respect to them, to people, birds and beasts, and to see everything about the world as part of one body, the warm flesh and blood of the awakened one, that we are part of one interconnected body. that we don't view as a kind of simple causal dependency, but we feel, as we feel about our own body, part of it. And we care about it, and we worry about it, and we want to take care of it. And we extend that mind to everything and everyone. So we can say the first half of this verse tries to offer a vision of things, of how we, with even a little bit of practice or realization, may glimpse of what it feels like to feel interconnected. And then the second half challenges us to confront the boundaries of that experience and that feeling. If by any chance they should turn against us, become a sworn enemy and abuse and persecute us, we should sincerely bow down with humble language in the reverent understanding that they are merciful messengers of the Awakened One. What does it mean to consider those who abuse and persecute us as messengers of the Awakened One? You see, I think that what this is suggesting is that although our practice may give us a glimpse of feeling like we are all one or all connected, when we're abused, threatened, persecuted, where does that feeling of interconnection go? How quickly it becomes us versus them? How quickly oneness breaks down into duality? So what's being said here is that if we want to maintain that sense of interconnectedness, we have to be grateful and understand what happens to cause it to break down. We have to see the ways in which our own vulnerability, our own reflexive defensiveness, causes us to suddenly put up a barrier and say, hold it, wait a minute, that's all the interconnectedness I can handle for one day. Right now I need a good boundary, right? I want to protect myself from you. And oneness has disappeared. And so we see that in a certain sense, those who threaten us are the reminders of the fragility of our own awakening, of our own sense of connection. And that is precisely the edge that Joko also always talked about, of where we need to practice, where our anxiety or anger or fear kicks in and creates separation. And the next lines say that these messengers are using devices to emancipate us from blind tendencies produced and accumulated upon ourselves by our own egoistic delusion and attachment. Now, I don't think it's proper to say that when something like the attacks in Paris happen, the people who have been murdered by terrorists in some sense are getting what they personally, karmically deserved, as if in some individual way the sins of their past lives are being visited upon them now in this form. I think that would be quite pernicious nonsense. However, to the extent that we acknowledge the reality of interconnection and the interdependent causality of all things, we realize the people who commit these crimes commit them out of their own fear, anger, and ignorance. And these things do not just well up in them spontaneously out of nowhere, but are a legacy of the human race's constant fearful reaction to its own impermanence and its own vulnerability. And that throughout history, everyone has reacted with self-defensiveness and aggression, trying to protect their little island of safety in a very unsafe world. And that we do not, as individuals, stand outside of that whole flow of human history just because we're Buddhists and like to think of ourselves as peaceful and non-violent or seeing through ignorance. We're part of a whole flow of life that contains this turbulence. And the challenge for us is precisely when we're attacked to see the common humanity of our attackers. This is not a justification or a call to merely turn the other cheek and not defend yourself or anything like that, but it's to see and preserve the sense of common humanity, that these are people like myself who have been pushed to some extraordinary limit that is probably unimaginable to me in the life I've led, to be pushed out of such fear to strike out this way. And it's precisely those who say, those people are monsters. Those people are doing unimaginable, inhuman acts. They're precisely the ones themselves who are inclined to call for further monstrous acts of retaliation or inhumanity in the name of self-defense. So this vow is primarily about preserving that sense of common humanity, even in the face of people who have lost that sense themselves, who have divided the world into us and them. Our response is to try to, at first, if only, dissolve that division in ourselves, to restore our attackers to humanity and see them as part of this one body, this one life. The end of the verse says something that for most of us is almost unimaginable. in each moment's flash of our thought there will grow a lotus flower, and on each lotus flower will be revealed perfection, unceasingly manifest as our life, just as it is right here and right now. Can we possibly see war and violence, even that, as a revealed perfection? Can we see through those things to a common frightened humanity? That like a small baby suddenly bursts into tears, flails his little arms and legs, strikes out, acts in anger and defensiveness and reactivity, but is still a baby, still perfect in who and what it is, doing the only thing it knows how to do, pretty much just like all of us.